Hey, this is Rob Pruse from The Spoons and Honeymoon Suite, and you are listening to Real Talk with Colin and Friends.
Tell no lies and don't talk back. Otherwise, you will definitely hear about it from Colin Sunday night.
Only on CJAI 101.3 FM, your island radio station.
Wondered about those bronze statues at the eastbound 401 Port Hope and westbound Trenton en routes? Renowned sculptor and now River Street writing author Ruth Abernathy joins me on episode 59 of the Real Talk franchise to talk about her amazing journey from growing up on a farm near Lindsay to becoming one of the most influential sculptors in Canada. In addition to the Highway of Heroes, Ruth's been commissioned to create works around the world, including her portrait of Oscar Peterson, which was unveiled in 2010 by none other than Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. From the shores of Lake Ontario in the heart of Amherst Island, Kingstown Auto Detailing is proud to present this episode of Real Talk Air, courtesy of our friends at River Street Writing and the 4,800-watt Chumley's Tower of Power. In form, life and legacies in bronze, Ruth Abernathy joins me on CJAI 101.3 FM right after this. Thanks to Kingstown Auto Detailing, the exclusive sponsor of the Real Talk franchise. Stop driving around in a dirty vehicle and get that new automobile feeling back. The dirtier the vehicle, the better. Contact Troy Pennock at 613-767-0862. Or visit Kingstown Auto Detail, 764 Baker Crescent, between Progress Avenue and Development Drive in Kingston. Troy loves what he does, and you won't find a more detail-oriented, passionate, personable, won't-stop-until-it's-perfect detailer. Avoid the embarrassment of having a messy car and visit Troy at Kingstown Auto Detailing. For more details, check out their website at KingstownAutoDetailing.com. And don't forget to like them on Facebook, too. Are listening to CJAI 101.3 FM's Real Talk Air, and I'm super excited to welcome our next guest to the program, Ruth Abernathy, who is an author and has a new book out, In Form, Life and Legacies in Bronze. And Ruth is kind enough to join us here on CJAI 101.3 FM. So Ruth, welcome to the program.
Colin, thank you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, and I'm really excited about this book. It's a beautiful book. I'll hold it up here. Obviously, only the audio is sharing. But as we were talking before we hit record, you know, one of the things that I just am fascinated about, I love to write. I don't think I'm very good at it, but it's therapeutic. And I do judge a book by its cover if I'm going to buy one. And I really love, it's a beautiful book. But I'm really intrigued. And I also noticed that there's a reference as revealing as Stuart McLean's Vinyl Cafe. My dad listened to Vinyl Cafe. Like, I remember everything CBC, but that was one of the programs he really liked. And I could absolutely envision this. So I guess, you know, before we dive into the book, you know, a little bit about yourself, Ruth, and how you became a published author. What was your journey?
Well, it's a long and rather convoluted tale, but I will offer a précis. Born in Lindsay, went to high school in Lindsay, but actually lived on a very small and rather mixed farm on the very edge of Victoria County. My parents, I mean, they were farmers, but really they were musicians who farmed. They were both very musical, and my siblings and I played music with them. We were a family band for a few years before the kids all left home. And that was solid. We played in every sense of the word. You know, it was a great deal of fun, and I think a bit of a hard scrabble area, in all fairness, but I would absolutely tell you that I won the lottery at birth. My parents had a lot of fun. They figured that was part of the deal. And I think we had more fun than anybody else I knew. growing up. Like just hysterical laughter, fun, and a great deal of family support. That kind of collaboration was a perfect setup. I mean, in all fairness, I loved lots about my childhood, but I was not going to spend my life on the farm. I really wanted to travel. There were a lot of things I wanted to do, but the collaboration of being a family group of musicians was the perfect setup for moving to work in the theater, which I did when I was 17, because of course we'd performed in Lindsay at the Academy. We were on stage. We knew the guy who ran the summer theater. I met Dennis, and you know, as long as I could hold a hammer, he was willing to bet that I would be useful. And once I had met the people, it was kind of a slam dunk. You know, I was useful. I grew up mostly without television. So there's this great, huge gap between me and cohorts who were truly starstruck. You know, we did see television, of course, at my grandparents, but, you know, there was no dashing home from school to watch fill in the blank and have that as a shared sort of social currency. No, nix that right in the beginning. But once I met the crew in theater, then it did sort of satisfy it made opportunity to travel with something that was truly creative. And I was useful at it. You know, you want an elaborate birdcage mat out of plastic bottles? I'm your girl. You know, I can do that. So from there, I went to Nanaimo very briefly to a theater program. I probably had been heading for architecture. I think the structure and buildings were a passion for me. But really, I kept going back to theater because I loved the bigger narrative of the script. You know, you're not just building stuff for the sake of filling the world with stuff. There's this bigger message, a bigger dialogue, and the difficulties of how humans interact and create friction with each other in the world we all inhabit. Like, that's really the fundamentals of it, isn't it? So I had, and of course, working in theater, you get very familiar with the Trans-Canada Highway. So a lot of back and forth. And I would offer too that we had relatives, for whatever curious happenstance, that we had relatives right across the country, you know, so it wasn't a matter of feeling regional. If something happened in the Maritimes, that affected family, or BC or Manitoba or Dryden, or, you know, we were curiously a family with a very large footprint in Canada, not terribly well connected. It was just real. from Port Alberni on the West Coast to the Maritimes, and in my work in theater. So for 20 years, you know, I'm traipsing about doing theater contracts and often coming back to the Stratford Festival because I was useful there, you know, and even full-time at the festival is 4 or 5 months a year. So you're there, you're doing whatever the season brings to you. And then, you know, you're either unemployed or back on the Trans-Canada. So that in itself was an interesting series of things. But, you know, I developed a phrase long ago that's, you know, women, but not all at the same time. And so I was trading some of the imagination. You know, I did 20 years in theater and I love doing hard things, but enough, you know, it's not that I was desperate to get out. By then I'd met the fellow that I married, and we had two small kids, and I decided maybe he had the career and I just had a job. But then I was asked to because I had carved all kinds of things in the theater, and I was asked to carve the figures that were eventually bronzed, and they are in front of the Stratford Festival. So really from that moment, once I met the foundry, there was no going back to the prop shop. I could carve. I mean, it's kind of, oh, but of course, you know, and there seemed an excellent preparation in the world of collaboration and ideas and working jointly larger than myself. It's a lovely springboard from all those active brains in the prop shop and in the theater to working with clients who in the end want something that is just a more permanent record of what it is they're celebrating. And I think with that path, and to be fair, by then I have kids, you know, a livelihood is not theoretical. You know, I'm not looking for a garret. I have, you know, little boys to whom sometimes I say yes, and sometimes I have to say no. You know, there's nothing lucrative about being an artist in this country. And I think from the prop shop to full-time professional sculptor, if you must, that's frying pan to fire. But I did have talent. And so, you know, after about 15 years, after 10 years, I started to wonder where the women were. Where are the women's portraits? I have sculpted one heck of a lot of lapels, all very deservedly. That was in the first 5 or 10 years. And then in 2011, my husband was offered a job in Vancouver. By then we were starting to convert our hay field near Wellesley into a place that we would live forever. I had had the unimaginable luxury of designing a home, and I designed one for two families, my husband and I, and my sister and her husband. So that was, you know, we were limping along on that front, and with some joy and a lot of laughter and a great deal of hard work. And then my husband was offered a job in Vancouver at the intersection of biology and engineering, which is what he always wanted to do. His family were in Vancouver. We looked at it. We set it aside. We came back to it. And then we met the owner of the company, and we were knocked sideways. You know, he was a remarkable man. He worked with a remarkable team. His wife was remarkable. You know, they take a quarter acre on Wikipedia. You know, I work with some daunting individuals. And he met Mark. I was there in the job interview. Don't ask me why that was. But in fairness, they knew they were wooing us both. They sure wanted Mark full time to start an engineering department in-house for stem cell technologies. I met Alan, and in the first two mouthfuls, we hit like 5 points of intersection. He wanted a sculptor because he wanted commemorations for some key scientists and engineers that built Canadian infrastructure and contributed spectacularly to the wealth of the country and the quality of life that we enjoy in living here. And he sent a list in 2011 of 5 projects he wanted to do, and the last one is being bronzed as we speak. So because Alan grew up in Nova Scotia, there were 2, 3, 4 projects now completed in Nova Scotia, another pair of portraits in Toronto of the two fellows who discovered the stem cell at U of T, and duplicates of them are at Science World in Vancouver, because BC now has a huge biotech component, and Alan was Entrepreneur of the Year for the ongoing spectacular growth of stem cell technologies, which is now a research center around the world. So, you know, I did the math because I was curious, even weighing Alan's collection into the mix. 90% of my commissioned work has been undertaken by private groups, you know, retirees, teachers, lawyers, you know, people who just want to do something larger than themselves. And I felt that was a pretty interesting statistic. You know, this is mostly an enormous percentage of projects undertaken by groups of people who just want to work collectively and do something lasting. And I would offer this through COVID. We all realized how boring our daily routines really were. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Don't go there. You know, those collective milestones are phenomenally important to our own sense of progress and development and achievement and shared experience. And when we are deprived of them, you know, we end up dazed and counting on our fingers. Like, where did time go? Why do I feel 10 years older when it's only been 4 years of dislocation? And that was an interesting reminder. You know, I feel like I've always been part of things that are celebrated, be it opening night or, you know, at the age of 13, playing for wedding dances. You know, that celebration is always the parameters of shared experience. And I think, to be fair, celebration is always a little beyond anyone's reach of convenience, right? Going that extra mile, you want to go into the backyard and go, wow, somebody really fluffed this up for the birthday party, you know? That kind of artistry, I think, is fundamental to any human gathering, you know, whether it's the birthday party of a 7-year-old or a funeral or a political convention. The visuals matter, the music matters, the words matter, and I think you just have to feast on it. You know, I mean, I don't like to see arts as sort of limited to a gallery setting. Stand here, look there. You know, you can, of course, and that's a big part of it over time, and a really important part of it. I think it disserves everyone to kind of separate the product of an artist from the product of any other profession. And I think it's easier to see as prisms. You know, we're all looking at the same factual world, or think we are, and yet a musician will come away with something in their mind that I know I'm not getting, you know?
Yeah.
I know that I'm seeing patterns in things that other people aren't seeing, or a poet or a performer, you know what I mean? That's the whole point. And that's the stuff of magic.
And I can relate to that because I've interviewed a fair number of musicians, and a lot of time I'll do what I call a featured artist spotlight, where I'll do a CD release and they'll play each song, tell me about the inspiration. So I'll make notes and I will say, this is where I think they were going with the song. And sometimes I get it right. And sometimes they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I guess it could mean that. And what it really speaks volumes about is it's so subjective. Art or music can mean so many different things to different people all at the same time. And, you know, what you said about going to an art gallery and being on that, you know, herded tour where you have to go or you're going to be behind on your audio. I know when I go to like a Hall of Fame music, like there's things where I will want to go deep and spend, you know, I toured Alcatraz and I just got rid of the audio because I just want to spend time and reading and do this. And some things I don't really have an interest and I'm going to shuffle on through pretty quick.
Yeah.
And whereas you and I could go and have a very similar interest and hobby or of a topic, but we could have completely different reasons for what interests and what we want to know or learn about it. And you know, just listening to you talk with the passion and conviction and, you know, being a sculptor, you know, you started out, as you mentioned, in Lindsay doing theater. I laugh because my brother, who is a resident of Amherst Island, of course, we broadcast from Amherst Island, and he did summer theater in Lindsay when he was going to university there.
For heaven's sake, for four
months, and this 6 degrees of separation. He had one of the two, I guess, whatever main roles. They did like four or five different plays, and the other person, Shalina Kennedy, no relation.
She's in Stratford.
Yeah, well, she has gone on to bigger and better things, and. Yeah. Carol Pope, who from Rough Trade, she's working on a musical about, you know, it's called Rough Trade the Musical, but it's a lot of has to do with her brother who passed away. And she asked me when I was talking, do you know Shalina Kennedy, any relation? And I'm like, I know that name. And then it dawned on me afterwards, like, oh, that's the same person there. So
that's great.
It's like that small little world. Like, what does Carol Pope of Rough Trade, 80s icon, my brother who's just Amherst Island, whatever, and you know, you're, there's all this little degree of I guess.
Well, and I think if you're in the arts, you know, it means that we're all on the same side. But I think I was asked the other day, you know, a question about AI and the impact of that, and I certainly with regards to the art, I mean, there's lots of shadow sides to AI, and I'm not going to wade into most of them because I'm ill-equipped to address them. But in the world of the arts, I have to hope that it brings more people into the conversation. You know, you've cobbled together something, and surely it heightens your awareness of the Eagles or Chopin when you understand that they did it out of their ether of their own experience, you know, without any of these gadgets. And
it's an interesting philosophical conversation, and I am torn on AI because I'm seeing all kinds of, like, the internet, there's so much good that could be done, but now you're starting to see ads where so-and-so, if you don't know any better, it actually sounds like certain people are endorsing certain things.
The shadow side is pretty daunting, isn't
Yeah, the dark, yeah, and they made movies about it. Like, that's what I don't understand. Why did we want to develop something like the Terminator? We should have learned from
Well,
the
yes, exactly.
you
You know, it is
know?
stuff of sci-fi now. If you're going to, if you doubt everything you see, then where do you go from there? You know,
And I love going to live theater. I love going to live music. I'm not sure if I want to go see Kiss as a hologram. I could just pop on the CD, honestly. And maybe it's because I was lucky enough to see them a few times live. You know, I remember when Natalie Cole did the duet with her dad, Nat King Cole, if you remember Unforgettable. I never really remember Nat King Cole. So maybe if I look at it from that lens, but again, I would rather watch a video, no matter how poor of the quality of a 50s or 60s recording, than having somebody replicate it today. Like, it just seems, I'm not seeing it. Like, it's not the real deal. Whereas even listening to a record, I know that person recorded it, or I went to see a play, whether it's Phantom or any of the others that I've, and I don't know if I'd want to see that being completely redone as a hologram. I'd rather watch the movie, you know? And it's an
Oh yeah,
interesting.
you know
Bill, and I think
what's
you can
that
argue
phrase?
it both ways.
There's some phrase that's a marketing slogan. You know, accept no substitutes, and I think it applies. You know, at some point, you still have to choose real life ahead of all of its, you know, I won't say cheap replications, but you know, I feel that I've had my share in spades, and some of that's an insistence that nothing else is as good, and some of that's a willingness to take risks, I think. But I would offer, is it a risk for a singer to sing? That's kind of my own phrase, but some people just have to, and I'm thrilled about that.
Yeah, I was in Nashville in the summer, and I heard Randy Travis coming out with a brand new song that is 100% AI. He wrote the song, but it's
Yes.
being performed through AI because he obviously has some health issues. And
Yeah.
technically, it's his work, but you know, if I had the right technology, I guess I could sound like Wolfman Jack, but it's not me, you know? Like,
Yeah.
I don't know how I truly feel about it, because I guess I go right to the dark side of it, right? What is it going? It's going to be used for nefarious purposes, but then, you know, I love the movie Jurassic Park, although I know it wasn't real. The concept of what if you can
Yeah.
bring dinosaurs to life and it's
But
safe.
I also think let's not underserve the human imagination. You know, I think, and I think too, let's it's like understanding that artists, although we all have that title perhaps, what we do is very skewed when you're going to sweep it all together as a product, right? And I would offer that I get a blast out of making stuff. Like that is a blast for me with very little comparison. And watching my brother play an instrument, my instrument, watching a performance of something, we as creators get a blast out of that that is beyond articulation. I don't think the bot is getting much out of it. So again, let's at some level, just in framing the conversation, let's get over the fact that the bot can do this. Who cares? You know, at some point,
Who
it's
taught the
like
bot to
teaching
do
my
that?
toaster to sing. Yeah, you could do that, but I think you have to see in the knowing of each other and the real acknowledgement of each other, then it is understanding that everyone you speak to is the composite of a life. They're standing there with their life experience as an aura around them. You know, you go down the street, you're not meeting policy, you're meeting people, and we have a lot of control. You know, if the 40 people that you speak to in a day create over time your life experience in Canada, then you've got a heck of a lot of control over that. You know, why give it away to some illusion? And I'm not challenging for the sake of looking for a fight, but it's more about determining quality in my own life and a certain sense of finesse and truthfulness. We've all seen so much fakery in film. Brilliant as it is, we know that this is, you know, that this is invention. that these are illusions, and the best illusions are the simplest illusions. You know, we're at one point, I'm sure, when Queen Elizabeth's bronze went into Toronto and they put in how many tons of sandstone beneath her, people probably were wowed that you could do such great honking things out of stone. Well, all those people who go home to granite counters don't give it a second thought. Don't spend your money on that. No one cares. You know, what people know as a collective thing changes every day. You know, we are all impacted by COVID in ways that we are still coming to terms with. But in that respect, I just go back to bronze, I think. Such bronze as a symbol, I would offer this because it is of interest. The discussion about making, I'm speaking specifically here of portraiture, which isn't by no means the sum total of my interests or my practice, but, you know, for the sake of recognition, bronze is not is symbolically strength in combination. That's the symbology of bronze, because there was a Bronze Age because they figured out how to mix copper with tin. And I read in a brilliant book about Radisson, as in Radisson Groslaers, there was no tin in North America. So they were never going to develop, they, the indigenous people, were not able to develop metallurgy the way it was developed in Europe because there was no tin supplies. You know, copper was great. They did lots of things with copper, but that's not the stuff of a knife or an axe or another weapon, you know? It was a lovely material, but it was never going to have the strength to be a tool. And I just think that often this idea of bronze is about reverence. And in actual fact, the symbology of bronze is the strength in combination, which I think is a beautiful metaphor for the best of working in bronze and the fact that it takes so many people to do it. You know, it really is unto itself all about collaborative effort, because the skills that it takes to do a process that has, you know, 14 steps in it is pretty remarkable. And we have foundries in Canada that are second to none. So in terms of authorship, you know, I knew after about 10 years that the pile of archives was getting kind of knee deep, and Alan insisted on book one. Yeah. And I, you know, I kind of stalled because books are pretty flat. Paper is pretty flat for me. But I knew he was right. I knew the material was in itself interesting, and there was enough body of work now to have some tooth to it. And it was another beautiful opportunity. You know, it's like, yes, you can have children. Are you going to say yes? You know, you don't have to, and it's okay if you don't. But, you know, certainly for the book, I was ready to try something that challenging. And I finished up the first book summer of 2015. We put that together. That was Life in Bronze. And of course, then everyone moves on. You know, it came out in 2016, was published. And I was really pleased with it. But Alan and I were still working. He had three or four more things he wanted me to do. So moving forward, then we finally just, you know, he had always spoken as though there would be a second book. And at that point, his wife, Connie, was quite unwell. So we set a very ambitious timeline for this second book. And because I wanted to feature their Eve's collection of installations, and Connie passed in March. Yeah. So this second book is dedicated to Connie Eves, who worked for BC Cancer for 50 years. She was a remarkable scientist, had her name on hundreds of papers, was inducted into the Hall of Fame in Edinburgh, I think. Just had made a remarkable contribution. So the timing for all of it was perfect. And then, of course, trouble with the Chinese printer, the choice to print in Canada, fast forwarded the whole endeavor. So we're now looking at, we have the luxury of making the book available now, where otherwise our promotion really had been directed to spring of 25. But, you know, we had books in hand in stacks in the warehouse in July. So we've put this together, and ultimately, it's good fun, you know, because it's ultimately a picture book. with a bit of detail. And that makes it a beautiful gift for anybody who's looking.
It's a great coffee table book. I love it.
Well, it is. And now we can all shop for coffee tables too. Those who work at home, they know all about it.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was really fun.
It's remarkable. It's a way to bring your very heavy sculptures into people's homes without putting your back out. I was looking at the one you did of Queen Elizabeth II that sits at the Ontario Legislature, 150% life size. So like 1.5 times larger than, and it's not just the statue of the queen. She's sitting in the throne. That's also 1.5 times.
Yes.
That's a pretty quote on,
big project. To be fair, I didn't know there was a throne of Canada, Colin, and there is. It sits in the Senate chamber in Ottawa. And when the call first came out, I was writing the first book when this call came out. It was an invitational call, which means that the clients had selected a very short list of artists that they wanted to consider it. And of the five they asked, there were four who responded. And it was a complicated call. And I think the call arrived in July and the first deadline was October. And, they wanted ideas on the queen standing and the queen enthroned. And, what were my thoughts on her on horseback? That had kind of been done. But anyway, we cobbled that all together. And ultimately, because I figured she should be seated, but the throne of Canada was perfect structurally, because in the end, there was a requirement to have a stone plinth because it's Her Majesty. She's not going to be at grade and people are not going to be crawling into her lap. But because it's viewed from below, I didn't want an exposed four-legged chair. I really wanted that velvet drapery, which is in fact integral to the actual chair. That was a really important part of the whole thing, to have it feel complete. And in fairness, when you think about it, although it was aligned with at that point an anniversary for the province of Ontario, she's the monarch of Canada. Until they change the rules, that's her job. And she's been really good at her job for a really long time by this point. So, it's not... there were a few other state chairs that might have been proposed, but I felt that the throne of Canada really was the right thing. So my assistant and I went to Ottawa and documented the chair, and lo and behold, it had quite a bit of damage. The unicorn's little horn had been knocked off, and there's gargoyles on various sides of the chair. These curious, probably the saints, I don't know who they are. Anyway, several of them had their noses knocked off and their ears knocked off. So anyway, that chair is now out being restored. Yeah. But in a curious way, there was a fire in the legislature, 1910. And a lot of stuff was damaged or destroyed. And so the replacements were just ordered. They needed a whack of stuff, and a whack of stuff was recreated or created for after the fire. And in that way, they didn't know very much about the chair. They didn't know who'd made it. They didn't really know very much about it. And so it's kind of a curious focus. And the backside, absolutely rudimentary. I was surprised, I did a maquette, like a small version of the design, just to illustrate. That was also part of one of the requests for the call. And, I can only access photos online of the front of the chair. So <Yeah. laughs> I'm making up what happens on the back, and I don't want it to be boring, and I don't want to underserve it. So I invented this some detail on the back. In actual fact, the back of the chair was absolutely simple. A little bracket to hold the fleur-de-lis in the top, and then just almost rough planks down the back. I've seen church chairs that were much more self-important. Wow. And of course, the real chair is 8 feet tall. So in bronze, it's 12 feet tall. And then I built two bronze steps beneath so that I could do the cascading fabric over one side. And silly as it sounds, it was an actual outfit. The Queen sat in the throne of Canada and spoke to Canadian Parliament in 77. And in my view, that's kind of a nice midpoint in a very long career. Yeah. And because she's out in a Canadian winter, I added the cape. partly because I like the animation of it, and partly because, for heaven's sakes, it's 40 below this morning, and the thought of her being out in the weather doesn't seem quite civil enough. You know, even though, you know, she's made of metal, I think, you know, we do relate to portraits. That's why we do them. That's why it never quite goes out of fashion. You know, if they're nicely rendered, it doesn't have to be literal, but somehow they give us the presence of other people, and we can never quite ignore them. Nor do I think we should, you know, in the same way, I don't think we should ignore each other.
Okay. Yeah, well said. And the cape gives her an added layer of protection of some of the BS floating around Queen's Park these days.
Hi, this is Carol Pope, and you are Shaking the Foundations with Colin Sunday Night, only on 101.3 FM, your island radio station.
You are listening to CJAI 101.3 FM Real Talk, and I am super excited and very humbled to be joined by Ruth Abernethy, taking us through some of her very prominent works. And they're just scrolling through, looking through the book. I really thought the bust or statue, the port, was that the correct? Do they say bust anymore?
Yeah. Well, I do. In the end, it's a portrait bust. I think Webster's does a definition of a portrait as two-dimensional. So I use figure portrait because in the end, that's exactly what it is. But that might be my invention. But yes, a portrait bust.
So the one of Ada McKenzie, founder of the Ladies Golf Club of Toronto in 1924. He did it for the 100th anniversary celebration for the club. And, you know, you think about golf as, you know, one of those sports that was very slow to evolve and inclusive inclusiveness, you know, to 1924. I through your art, I did not know that that's when the first ladies golf club was in Toronto. So again, here's another example of art bringing history to life, and which is very cool.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable. And in the end, in 1924, she was already a renowned golfer. She, I can't give you her CV, you know, very accurately, but a renowned golfer. And she was coming back, crossing the Atlantic with someone else, with whom she'd played in Europe. And she said, you know, they'd cooked up this plan to start Ladies Golf Club in Toronto. And they did. And it is the only ladies club in North America. Now, men can play as guests. They're quite welcome. And many men do. It's a beautiful course. But it's the only ladies only course in North America. There was another one started in New York, I think, at the same time, but it evolved in a different way and has not sustained as a ladies only. No, she was fun. You know, she was just fun, and the photos of her are fun. You know, everything about her is absolutely positive. You know, at that point in time, because she was, oh my gosh, let's use the word, she was a spinster, right? And the banks don't give mortgages to spinsters, not in 1924, at least. And she wrangled some amazing deal where she was going to raise money, you know, through friends privately. And she'd approached this beautiful property north of Toronto. And it was an older couple, you know, they'd had the farm for many years, but in the end, they were going to downscale, and they were exactly what she was looking for. And they settled on a price, and then she was banging the walls down trying to fundraise. And she'd gone to, I can't remember, the story's great. She'd gone with some guy who owned the Leafs, I think, pretending that they were a couple in order to get donations or talk to the bank. Like, the whole thing has just, it just smacks of invention and scraping the barrel. And then, and she came up, she was $2,000 short, and she finally, you know, went to somebody who disapproved of the whole project and said, you know, I don't think you can make this work, but here's the final $2,000. Yeah. And she got it. And it's a remarkable club. It really, the grounds are stunning. You'd never know it was there, just given the way the roads and streets run. It's really very secluded. And the energy, I have to say, you know, lots of groups of women operate in ways that would leave one a bit confounded. But the energy at that gala is the stuff that moves mountains. The joyfulness and the positivity and the willingness to just get in there, get a plan and get it done. Oh, my gosh, they would just knock your socks off.
Yeah.
It was great. And yeah, I've gone in. I was all prepared to say no to that project because I was tired. You know, we'd gotten through COVID. I'd gotten through three weddings and three serious family funerals. And I'd had it, you know, I just, and I, but I thought it's not fair to just send an email to say, I can't bear it. And I went in and I met with Carol and I met with Yvonne, and they were exactly the women that I wanted to feel well served with what I can do. And the story was good, but they were just as good. And luckily, to be fair, their time frame allowed me a bit of breathing space. And so I didn't take it on until the following winter. But yeah, what a blast.
A remarkable piece of art, but even more remarkable is the story. And I definitely want to learn more about her history. And like I said, I'm learning for the first time that
I know.
And to hear that it's the only one in North America that is still sustained, you know, 100 years later.
Yeah. And it was designed, you know who it was? Sorry, it was Stanley Thompson. When she was hunting for money, it was Stanley Thompson, the golf course designer. And the two of them went and kind of pretended to be a couple for a few sites, banging for money and talking to people. But he designed the course. I think it's a very laudable course, the handicap. Like, I don't speak golf, so I have to not get myself in, you know, up to my armpits. But a fabulous course to play. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Most men's courses don't want me hacking up their greens, so I'm sure I'll never be invited to play there, but I'm going to
Prince Divot.
Yeah, learn about it. But a couple other things. I know we're getting close to time for the show, but there's two I wanted to ask you about. Oh, there's many more, but the Highway of Heroes, which is, you know, very near and dear to all of our hearts in Eastern Ontario, where it begins. And but before we talk a little bit about that, the Empty Seat. I'm just scrolling through your website, which is ruthabernethy.com, and you can learn all about Ruth and her work. But there's some great photos here. There's no description on this one. So Empty Seat. I love it. I want to hear more about that.
Well, I was contacted by a PhD student probably 15 years ago, and she was talking about her focus of study was the series of commemorations installed in Canada for events that had happened overseas. So this is works in Winnipeg, the Ukraine, the pogroms against the Ukrainians in the, not something I know that much about. There are commemorations across this country, dozens of them, commemorating events elsewhere, because the people who come here have the chance to mark that as part of their history. And in essence, part of our collective history by association. And that really took some examination on my part, because that's an interesting thing. You know, I don't know that that could be said of other countries, you know, and we're this odd recipient, you know, people don't emigrate because it's better where they are. And Mielke's book on 1867, you know, this is, you know, talking about Canada and cancel culture and whatever. And I won't wade into my chin there, but, you know, he makes the astute comment that at any point, you can only make comparison with quality of life and personal liberties with one place compared to other places around the globe at the same point in history. And in every case that he could, every way he could examine it, you know, Canadians were doing better than many at any point throughout their history. And so we are this repository for people who bring experiences from away. And in essence, that's what happened with the Empty Seat. It was a group of clients for whom I'd done a prior project the massacre at Tiananmen Square. And certainly one of the ideas that we gave airtime to, this we being myself and my editor, was how history is written. You know, I'd like a buck for every time people said to me, oh, you can't change history. And that in literal sense is true. You cannot change the actions of history, but you can certainly change how you scrutinize that and how you examine that, or how you challenge what's written about it, and how you know the truths of any moment in history as it's written. You know, it's only written by other humans who are as flawed as ourselves. And how we view it is absolutely within our control, and certainly something we can change. So this group of people, this was Democracy in China Day, and I'd done a piece for them that was about the Tiananmen Massacre, which happened about a month before my wedding. And we did a commemoration for them at York U. And then a few years later, they came back to me and asked if I couldn't do the empty seat, the empty chair, in honor of a Chinese dissident who had been locked up and then was awarded his a Nobel Prize for peace. But of course, the Chinese did not want to let him out of jail to receive his award. So in the ceremony, those exquisite chairs, Swedish chairs with it's a blue, gray and silver tapestry. They're just exquisite. And the Peace Prize is given in Stockholm and in a different location than the other science prizes for Nobel. And having done a Nobel Prize that's now at Acadia University in Nova Scotia, this is a different chair. So we checked out this chair and replicated it in bronze with that spectacular tapestry in silver. It's almost cross stitch, like it's very Scandinavian, a gorgeous chair. But in the ceremony, they have chairs out for all recipients and a certificate on each. And because the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo was not allowed to be there, his chair was stunningly silent and empty through the ceremony. And ultimately that's the design. You know, there was a photo taken and they just asked if we could do the empty chair. And it's now, I think, in Ottawa at the Amnesty International is the site in Ottawa. But it's hard to wrap your imagination around, you know, and at some point take a deep breath and know how much personal freedom we enjoy in this country. It's all I can figure.
I couldn't have said it better, Ruth. And contrary to what's being sprouted on social media, whether it's bots or otherwise, we do live in a very free country and one of the best places. People still want to come here, and we are recognized globally as our freedom, and something I never take for granted. And I think it's such a powerful message, and it's got to be humbling that you get to bring this story to life through your art and your vision. I guess it's got to be a deeply personal, I guess, do you ever reflect on
it's
that?
It's an honor. Oh, like, my goodness. You know, I mean, to
can
the
you
question.
Put it in words?
It feels like an honor. You know, it really does. Like to the question of, can you sculpt Glenn Gould? Well, yes. You know, because I can say yes to that question, I get to work consistently with people who are bringing their very best to any project, you know, and we are, I get to hang out with the legacies of people that are just second to none. You know, this is Oscar Peterson. This is, I would include prime ministers in that, you know, dear Lord, what a job. You know, all political careers end in failure. But, you know, musicians and painters and
Margaret
scientists
Atwood.
And, well, exactly, Margaret Atwood. Like, they're just a daunting list. I did a portrait.
You're talking about who's who. Like, you're talking about iconic Canadian and or world events. You know, I see Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, and it was just one of those sort of flukish things. The contact came to me through a company that actually does copper work in the way that the Statue of Liberty is done. But someone in this tiny town of Pittsfield, you know, population 4,200 people, had put up the funds because Lincoln worked in Pittsfield as a lawyer before he entered politics. And he hired as as president, he hired John Hay and John Nicolay to be his two young secretaries. And he adored them both. They were sort of like sons to him. And Hay, in fact, wrote the biography of Lincoln after his death. And Hay was in politics for 60 years. But because the two young men were from Pittsfield and Lincoln worked there as a lawyer for several decades before entering politics, you know, they were working on their heritage economy, and someone had put up the money to have the three of them portrayed. And originally they'd asked for half figures. And I said, well, you know, you don't really have the money for that. And I would offer a half figure. Looks like you've been tossed through the table saw. Like, let's not do that. There's another way to do that. The money was a bit scant, but to do just one misses the point. You know, they were both local boys, and Lincoln's presence was real in the town and formative, totally formative of their lives. And this is Pittsfield. This is their story. There are 22 places in this tiny town of Pittsfield where Lincoln would go for dinner or stay overnight or, you know, whatever. Personal heritage stories in the way that, you know, we have our, what we have, Niagara on the Lake is kind of it. But really, yeah. Pittsfield has like 4,000 people, period. Yeah. And, you know, it's just one of those. I was told at the time that I'm the only Canadian to have sculpted Abe Lincoln for a public place in the States. Don't stake your life on it. It was someone who had researched all 327 portraits of Lincoln, and they were quite credible as an academic, so I take them at their word. But, you know, I feel like I walk around and wait to be struck by lightning. You know, I really do get to work with people who bring their very best to a project, and that's humbling. There's no phoning it in. You know, there's no phoning it in. You just stare it down and then get on with the steps. It's very methodical, you know, but really I never have to put up with anyone's shortchanged efforts, you know, and that's remarkable. That's just remarkable.
Yeah, and I am truly humbled, Ruth, that you've taken the time to come on and share your stories with this humble little independent radio broadcaster here.
No, we've stayed on Amherst Island, actually.
Oh, you have been there.
Yeah. The Franklin the Turtle installations in Toronto were designed and conceived by, you know, this is the Kids Lit, done by Leslie Coates, who was a Toronto staffer. And she and her husband had a place just down the road for a few years. And I babysat for him. He was an ancient literature prof at Victoria College. Again, I walk around and wait to be hit by lightning, you know, Andrew Paytonall. And they were on the island and asked if we'd go down and have a visit. Well, yeah, it's cool. Beautiful. See, again, my goodness.
So when you get off the ferry and go to the right, there's a barn. And we broadcast from the old dairy barn, the milk barn on Amherst Island. And that is our world headquarters will always be over on the island where the tower is from. And that's so cool that you have that connection to our little community. And before I let you go, Ruth, I got a million questions, but only about 3 or 4 minutes to wrap this up. The Highway of Heroes, the statue, where could we find that? Where is that actually?
That's a classic 401. The en route stops eastbound in Port Hope and westbound in Trenton, just west of Wooler Road are the two stops. And this is en route, the coffee shops along the 401, framing the Highway of Heroes. Mark Cullen wanted to plant trees, one for every fallen service person. And he's been doing it. He's been finding, getting permissions all along that corridor and has been planting trees. And they wanted something to connect tree planting with military service. And in the end, I wanted something that was as inclusive as possible. All time periods, all genders, all ethnicities, you know, let's not get the cookie cutters out here. We want everyone as broadly as we can portray them. And presence and absence is really the point. And in that case, some of the people on it's a profile shot of an individual done as an open space. And then what's left between the faces was carved into foliage and cast in bronze. And the whole thing is circular, cylindrical, and it's got this contoured outer surface, and then it's got a screen inside, so it's like a giant night light, and there are lights inside of them. I love the idea. You know, I had the idea on the phone years ago, and it was cut in stainless steel, and this was a more dimensional version. But in the end, we were able to honor 62 individuals, most of whom are times past, but a number of them are still living, and it really does make the connection that what is between us is actually as solid as each of us as individuals. And that's the lasting bit, you know, those connections. And I have to say, in doing the John McCrae and doing the Highway of Heroes, the commitment that I met in service personnel was tangible. They were a remarkable bunch.
I drive that often. I have never seen that. I do stop at the en routes. I'm usually hitting a drive-through, so I'm going to make it a point.
Yeah, they're right there in the garden, and they're 7 feet tall, but really.
I know. I can tell it towers over both of the you and the individual in that picture. It's remarkable.
Yeah. They're not lit often, and I don't know what schedule that is. Like the en routes are privately owned, and the owners... Right. And they were sold in the middle of the project. You know, it's never simple. But the new owners gave us a welcome, and the sites were actually there in existence already. So I was very pleased with that. It was a real honor to put that together. We had the Silver Cross Mother as a VIP at the service. And a significant corridor, vastly enhanced. I think 1.5 million trees, Mark's put in there along that corridor, like literally from the Kipling start point to the Trenton exit.
Remarkable. Ruth, I could go on about this all night. I might have to get you to come back on and see us again sometime. Sure. Inform Life and Legacies in Bronze, Ruth Abernethy with Angie Littlefield. And you definitely need to check out ruthabernethy.com for a great behind the scenes look at the photos. I've been on the website. That's why my head's been turned a lot of it here as I'm scrolling your website on my other monitors, Ruth. But there's also really cool, an interactive map of your commissioned sculptures there. So I was going to ask you, where the hell is this? And I'm like, well, it's right here. I'm going to look it up. Yeah. I'm just so very thankful that you took the time to come and share not only your work, but your journey, how you got there. And it's just been a real treat for me personally. So last question. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about, you know, maybe portraiting like a independent DJ kind of sitting on a radio? You know, we got a new studio coming in. Yes. That would look pretty cool.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. There you go. Think size, think scale.
Yeah. And probably on my budget, it's probably about the size of maybe.
Yeah. We don't Remember have the a thing big... that we used to get in the box of tea? Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking those Kinder surprises, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, very good. Very good.
But Ruth, this has been very fun, very informative. And I really look forward to watching and learning more about your works and especially the stories behind that. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure, Colin. All the best. Yeah.
Ruth Abernethy.
Hey, this is Ed the Sock, and you're listening to Real Talk, in case you were wondering what you've been wasting your time with, on your Amherst Island Radio.
This is Al Harlow, and you are listening to Kingston's favorite radio station, Island Radio, 101.3 FM.